Hi, and welcome to the Midlife Feast, the podcast for women who are hungry for more in this season of life. I'm your host, Dr. Jen Salib Huber. I'm an intuitive eating dietitian and naturopathic doctor, and I help women manage menopause without dieting and food rules. Come to my table, listen and learn from me, trusted guest experts in women's health, and interviews with women just like you. Each episode brings to the table juicy conversations designed to help you feast on midlife. And if you're looking for more information about menopause nutrition and intuitive eating, check out the Midlife Feast community, my monthly membership that combines my no-nonsense approach that you all love to nutrition with community so that you can learn from me and others who can relate to the cheers and challenges of midlife. Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of the Midlife Feast. Before I introduce my guest today, who I'm so excited to have on the podcast, I want to kind of just bring up a question that I get a lot that I'm hoping this podcast episode will answer for you. And that is, why don't diets work? I can't tell you how often people will say, can you just tell me in a way that I'll believe that diets don't work? Why did it used to work? Why does it work for my friend, my neighbor? Why does my doctor say that they work? Why do I keep looking for the one that's going to work? And, you know, I often will do my best, I think, to try and explain to people why diets don't work, but it's hard. But as an intuitive eating dietitian, you know, we live in this bubble of generally people who, you know, either work in this space or already believe that. And I'm not always used to kind of going back to the how do we know why diets don't work? So all that to say, Dr. Amy Porto is my guest today. And Amy is, as always, someone that I found connected on Instagram with. She's come into the Midlife Feast community as a guest expert. And she really is an expert. She is a nutrition professor. She has a PhD in nutrition. She's a non-diet, anti-diet dietitian. And she's really passionate about making nutrition easy, which is absolutely part of my mission as well. And I think you're really going to love this conversation. And I hope that if you take one thing away from it, it's that you feel excited again about food and feel maybe you can imagine what a life without diets could look like without being afraid, without the fear that comes with it so much. So buckle up. This is a good one. Welcome, Dr. Amy Porto, to the Midlife Feast. How are you?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, I'm excited to have you on the show. Feasters in the community will recognize you because you came in and did an amazing guest expert session on sugar myths, debunking all the sugar myths back in December, I think it was, end of the year anyway. But, you know, I'm a big fan of your work. I'm a big fan of the language that you use, the way that you talk about food, and there really isn't anyone else that I would be more excited to talk to about this topic, which I'm sure you get this question all the time too, but people will say, I love what you say and I love how you say it, but can you just tell me one more time, why don't diets work? Like, why is it me? Why doesn't it work? So that's what we're going to talk about today, folks. We're doing it. We're talking about why diets don't work. So you get that question, right? It's not just me.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's I think sometimes for us, when we're in this space where we work, you know, and if you're spending time on social media or the podcast you listen to, we hear the same messaging and forget that maybe some people don't hear that messaging, you know, that we're hearing a lot of times and it might be new to them.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been in this non-diet world now for, I think close to 10 years, if not just a little over 10 years. My bubble's pretty big. So there definitely are weeks that go by that I kind of forget that, oh yeah, there's still a lot of diet culture out there.
Yeah.
So I'm going to pretend to be somebody who's asking me the question that I get all the time, which is, why is it that when I used to do this, insert diet here, calorie counting, point tracking, macro counting, whatever, it worked. So I know that diets work for me. It's just not working now. And I'd love to hear how you answer that or kind of what your thoughts are on that.
So you used and I love first, let me say thank you for saying how you like the language that I use, because I'm going to pick up on language that you just used in that example, which is the language that folks use when they talk about it and saying that this worked for me. And the word there that it worked, in that maybe for a short amount of time, you know, there was weight loss that was experienced as a result. But if the goal, and I think what most people mean when they say it worked, right, is that you lost weight. But if you're going back to it, then did it work because you weren't able to sustain that for long periods of time? And I think oftentimes we think about, well, I stopped doing the habits, the recording, the whatever was involved in that particular program or system or plan or method or whatever we're calling it. And if I just got back to doing that again, then it would work again. Yeah. And I think for some people, maybe that might be true again until you stop doing that plan, program, method, because the sustainability of that as people who live life, you know, you are going out and whatever your responsibilities are in your home, in your life, in your work, and you're caring for others, life happens. And it's just not something that is what's usually required to have that result, for lack of a better word, is something that we just can't sustain and just live in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And so let's talk a little bit about the internet's favorite saying, every gym bro's favorite saying, it's all about calories in and calories out. So let's talk about that, because that's true and not, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I look at it, I come a lot from, I guess, as a dietitian to a lot of the courses I teach as a professor is coming from like the food science end and food laws and regulations and things like that, particularly in the United States. And one of the things that I always think is interesting is how meticulous, first of all, we are with the calories in part. So if we are tracking down to the whatever value or making sure it's the exact right brand of bread to get those numbers right. But when we look at the laws within the United States, the rounding rules to round things up or down, you know, there's no way that that particular brand is exactly 100 calories or 120. Everything's in perfect increments. So we're already off by like margins of potentially 20%, depending on what it is that we're looking at. So even the data that we're collecting, assuming, is not accurate from that standpoint. We've gotten a little bit better from the accuracy on the output compared to, I don't know, when I was like in college and high school and on the treadmill and you knew that the calorie output was like not at all close. Yeah. And it's not much better, but a lot of the devices now that people strap to themselves in all different kinds of ways are a little bit better, but there's a huge margin of error. So even the tracking methods that we have are not accurate to start with. So that makes that's a problem to do that. Mm-hmm. It's also, what are the methods we're using to make those calculations? You know, how are we estimating what the needs are going to be? How are we estimating just how much it's going to take to beat your heart and breathe in air and all of those things? So we're also starting with like a flawed system to begin with before we even get thinking about metabolically how any of that is going to work.
Yeah, I call them false prophets, you know, those numbers. Because you can look at a package, and if you were to take 10 of those packages, it would be almost like winning the lottery if one of them had exactly what was on the label.
Yeah. Yeah. I almost wish we were back into the days where we got out the old bomb calorimeters. You know, you would take the food in and we could actually calculate how much burned energy, if you actually burn the food, you know, how much energy do you get, which is kind of that idea.
Yeah. And so when people feel like they're doing all the right things because they are counting, measuring, tracking the input and doing their best to estimate the output, they're not taking into account the very large margin of error on both of those numbers.
Yeah. Right? And that's just exactly. And you're also only accounting for that, right? And not so many other things that are happening in your own body, in your season of life, in all the other things that impact more than just input and output.
Yeah. So now let's talk a little bit about what happens after the diet. So lots of people have probably heard these statistics. We're not going to get into the details of those, but essentially diets don't work. We have lots of you know, data to tell us that there's a very small percentage of people who are almost like unicorns who can actually achieve and maintain weight loss for 5 years or more, right? Mm-hmm. And we actually have quite a bit of science to tell us why that is. So one of the things that you talked to my community about mm-hmm. was about this really fascinating experiment called the Minnesota Starvation Experiment. Right?
Yeah.
So, let's have a little discussion about that. So when was this? What was this? What happened?
Yeah. So it's always an interesting thing. Some of the things that I do in my work as a university professor is working with students on research projects. And so this experiment is always an interesting one to talk about because in today's day, we are working with ethical review boards and things in order to actually have research be conducted in a way that isn't harmful in any way to subjects. And then you look back at this study in the 1940s and think, wow, some of the things, even though they were informed of what was happening, it's kind of wild to think through. So in the Minnesota Starvation Experiment, this was done, named because of the University of Minnesota, where it was conducted. And the purpose, to my understanding, is really was to kind of rehab people who had been essentially starving during World War II. And what was going to be the best way to provide food aid in a way that was going to help to nourish them based on, long periods of time without being able to eat. And so, the thinking at that point is, well, if you're going to be studying what is going to be beneficial for people who had been without food for a long period of time, then we need to mimic that by doing these, studies on people who haven't been eating food for a long period of time. And so this is where, we would never have something like this passed in today's day and age. But the subjects in the studies were conscientious objectors to the war. And I think that part is a part to note based on some of the impact that happened, when they weren't eating. And this was one of the ways in a sense that they were able to serve as research subjects. So there were several hundred people, if my memory serves correctly, that applied to be subjects to participate, but only 36 to 40, I think, were chosen after going through a lot of physical testing, for mental well-being. So at least there was foresight to think through that. And these were people who knew the details of the study. So while maybe the methods weren't ethically great, they knew essentially what they were signing up for, maybe not what the impact was going to be. And so what the researchers needed to do was establish a baseline. Their goal was to see how could they be fueling people properly after they had been deprived of food during a long period of time. And so they had to set the stage with this group of subjects to be deprived of food for, a certain period of time. And they decided on like a 3-month period to do that, where things were, to their credit, they were monitoring physically and mentally what was going on with the subjects, who all lived together in kind of like a dorm setting. They ate together. They had, for lack of a better word, like jobs to do, which was basically, keeping the grounds going, and maybe they could go for a walk. And a lot of them did walk. I think it was up to like 3 miles a day or so, because there was nothing else to do, while you were there. And what I always think is the impactful part of this study is, as they were, going through this process to just kind of get a baseline of where they were at in those first 3 months. And then the next period of that, their intake of food, which everything had been provided for them, was cut in half. And that half, to kind of even be somewhat ethical, was considered semi-starvation for this group of men. And that's always an important part to keep in mind, because they were still encouraged to do their jobs through the dorm, still, to go through and walk. But you saw those changes pretty quickly in terms of how their strength decreased. They weren't interested in being as active. They were tired. And one of the things mentally was an assessment showing how apathetic they were just about the state of the world in general, which was interesting for a group of men who were very outspoken about being objectors to the war, now really didn't have an opinion on much. And so just even that energy to put towards something that was important to them, or that they were invested in, they were used to kind of being for the cause, and that wasn't really of interest. So they also have a lot of data about, and I say this kindly, everybody that you and I know who have been on a diet, and every listener knows who's been on a diet, where all of a sudden all they do is talk about the diet and what they're doing and how they're eating and all the food. And let me show you these recipes. You know, like if they had had Instagram back there, I'm sure they would have been taking selfies of the food in the cafeteria. But all they talked about was food. They wanted food. And I thought it was interesting because there were some men that actually requested cookbooks for the library. And so, you know, they weren't doing any cooking. The food was provided to them in this dorm-like setting, but even just like a heightened interest in food. And I think we can see that a lot of times where when we're on a particular diet and calories have been decreased, you know, we do get just this physiological response to be more interested in food for our own survival. But also, it's also kind of looked at, well, of course you're interested in that. You know, you're taking care of your health, you're cooking more, you're doing all of that. So, in this group, these men had unlimited access, like to all the water they wanted, all the coffee they wanted, and all the gum that they could chew. And I always think those kind of things are interesting. They had recordings of some men chewing like 30 to 40 packs of gum a day just to have something in their mouth. And that isn't even so far out of the realm of, you know, possibilities. I had someone share with me who had gone through eating disorder treatment, how that was something that she really connected with when I talked about this study, was how much gum she chewed during that time when she was going through, you know, and coming through treatment. They were drinking a lot of coffee a day. I think we see that mimic now. We do a lot of caffeine and things to like stave off hunger, but also to keep up energy because you're not taking in enough calories. There was even, if I remember, one report of one subject who was dismissed from the study who was dreaming about cannibalism. So it really went to an extreme.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's just, it's wild. And of course, you know, you would expect if you cut somebody's calories in half, of course, the size of their body's changed. But what was interesting, I even think also perspective-wise, and it really relates just to how, you know, culturally we act even now, they were really becoming almost emaciated over time, but they didn't see themselves that way. And they, you know, because you're collectively in a group of all people who are also losing weight at the same time, but they were having different views of the researchers, of the people who were providing food, of all of these people who were kind of involved in the study just to keep things going, who had not changed. And suddenly they were kind of seeing them as being much larger than they were. And so this kind of body dysmorphia, as they got smaller, they were viewing people whose bodies hadn't changed as being bigger than they did. And the important part of like all of that happened, and they didn't even really start the research study yet. You know, they were just trying to get people to the point to actually start the study. And so the part that always stands out to me with that is, you know, the language here is semi-starvation is what they were really talking about. And, you know, I know we're not big ones to talk about numbers all the time, but in this case, I think it's important to turn, you know, to talk about it is semi-starvation for this group of men was around like 1600 calories. And the difference between, you know, men and women's needs are pretty negligible for the most part. And if we think about so many of the diet plans that we have now, you know, how many times have we seen some 1200 calorie a day diet plan, particularly
every
for women?
Day.
Yeah, all the time. And we know it's like, okay, that's enough for a four-year-old. But that is really difficult, I think, for a lot of folks to take in because it's what we've seen in every magazine and every social media scroll and every, this is how your macros should break down. Like 1,200, 1,400, 1,600 are numbers that we see. So they're so normalized. And here we're talking about a group where they were being like in semi-starvation and not seeing that as being problematic. And even when you look globally at like undernourished areas of the world, that's also kind of numbers that we're talking about, 1200, 1400 calories a day. And yet we don't connect that to something that we're, you know, people are looking at as being a healthy type of thing to engage in. So it's interesting.
I need to interject this thought because I can already hear people's brains moving.
Yeah.
So, you know, the wheels are turning How many times do people feel like there is something wrong with them?
Yes.
Because yes. They're hungry when they're eating 1,200 calories or 1,400 calories.
Yes.
They're like, I'm doing something wrong. Do I need more protein? No, you need more food.
Right. Like, yeah. Like, and the messaging is, you know, well, you know, you have to have more willpower and you're going to bed and you're really hungry. And, you know, I don't know, you hear, well, that must mean it's working. You know, because you're starving, but like your body's trying to keep you alive. You know, and that's the thing. Like, if you're exactly right, is you do have that feeling of like, I failed this and other people can do this and I can't do this and there must be something wrong with me. But it really is your body doing you a service in a sense, yeah. Even though it might not feel that way. So
okay. That was, sorry for the interruption. I just wanted
to. No, please do. I could ramble on about this for a long time.
No, but let's keep going though. So, okay. So then the experiment starts, the actual experiment starts.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so a lot of that, they didn't really even go much further into a lot of the experiment itself because they were seeing all of the physical impact and the mental impact that a lot of these subjects were having. And so there were, I think some of the interesting things in them, it were really, I mean, the physical part is an important piece, but the mental health part is, I think, a part that gets overlooked a lot of like the idea that I mentioned already, like, let's get cookbooks for the library. And when things were kind of wrapping up, there were a handful of the subjects that then went on to become chefs who had never expressed any interest in food before. You had people who were interested more in athletics in ways that they hadn't been before. And I think that parallels a lot to, you know, even in the fields that we are in dietetics, you know, a lot of times, how do people come to the profession or how do things change? Because you've been so invested and it's had such an impact on what it is that you spend a lot of your time on that it can become your identity in a lot of ways.
So yeah, so they go through this starvation experiment, mm-hmm. essentially, and their interest in food increased. Mm-hmm. They were looking for things to do with their hands and their mouths, right?
Yep.
And so if you think about what happens to every dieter, initially, the diet is fun, it's new, it's novel, and it quote unquote works.
Right.
So your efforts are rewarded. Mm-hmm. But then the novelty wears off, as every novel thing does, right? The novelty wears off. Your body gets tired. Your mind gets tired of trying to maintain the restriction and do more with less. Mm-hmm. Right. And all of a sudden, you're interested in food that you don't even like anymore, like you didn't like before.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Like, Let's take, you know, the poor misunderstood rice cake, right? You know, a rice cake, I've had a few good rice cakes. I've had a few good rice cakes with things on them.
Yes.
In and of themselves, they're cardboard, right? Mm-hmm. Like plain rice cakes, they're just cardboard. And yet, anybody who's dieting will look at a sleeve of those with like stars in their eyes.
Yes. Right? And if they're chocolate flavored, oh my goodness.
Right? Yeah.
You hit the jackpot.
But if all things were equal, would you choose to eat that?
Right.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Right? So which goes to satisfaction, which we talk about so much in the intuitive eating world too, but like you have to enjoy your food.
And can I touch on one thing you just said that just stuck out to me because it makes so much sense talking about, you know, you're doing all these things and it's new and it's novel and it's fun and until that kind of wears off. And then what we tend to do is then let's try the new one. There's this new program over here and it says I should eat these foods at this time of day or not at this time of day in this order. And there's these new rice cakes or bars or powders or things I have to do. So it's all new again, you know? And so there's never a chance to kind of have that satisfaction with any type of food or the idea of kind of making peace with certain types of foods that you feel you can't have around because everything is new and exciting. And as soon as it isn't, I'm going to go to the next thing that's new and exciting because that'll be the thing that will work. And it keeps us in this constant state of just being heightened and excited about things and never really knowing what do I actually like.
And if you imagine that cycle on repeat for 25, 35, 45 years,
yeah,
you end up in a place where you don't even know what you like what yes. you want, what you can or can't have, and every decision about food, even if you're eating. So we're not talking about people who aren't eating. We're talking about people who are eating. But every decision about food is fraught with indecision, decision fatigue, anxiety, regret, guilt.
Yeah.
There's never a point where you feel confident that you can feed yourself.
Yeah.
Competently. Right?
Yeah. That's absolutely true.
That is the real failure of diets, in my opinion, is that they don't actually teach you how to eat. Teaching you how to eat less to weigh less is not teaching you how to eat well.
Yeah. And it's an interesting thing too, I think, that you have this internal battle of, I think if you've had the 10, 15, 20 years of doing that cycle, where there's a frustration of like, oh my goodness, someone please just tell me what to eat. Just tell me what to eat.
Oh, yeah.
Coupled with, no one's going to tell me what to do. Now there's that inner battle of please tell me. And I often will push back with clients on that to say, well, I don't know that you really, I know that you're saying that, but think of that, because you could go do a Google search right now and there are plenty of people who will tell you what to eat and give you a detailed breakdown. And some of them will even just tell you that for free. So that information is there. There are plenty of people. So it's not really what you want. It's that wanting to be able to figure that out for yourself after the ability to do that has kind of been stripped away.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yes. So just to kind of try and summarize what we're trying to say here, diets, quote unquote, work in that if you restrict calories and intentionally or unintentionally eat less than your body needs, sure, you're going to lose weight. The scale is going to go down.
Yep.
But we have systems, biological, psychological, all the systems in place to resist that.
Yeah.
And we cannot maintain that restriction indefinitely without having an impact on how we feel in our bodies.
Yeah.
And that those side effects, as you know, I've talked about before with other guests about weight cycling, you know, like there are side effects to pursuing intentional weight loss that really makes, I describe it as people are not getting informed consent when they're putting people on diets, because not a single person that I ever know has been told that the risk of weight cycling is an independent risk factor for at least cardiovascular disease and diabetes and probably many other things, right? So if we're trying to talk about why diets don't work, it's not just that they don't work, it's that they probably cause harm.
Yeah. And that's such a big conversation too, because then it really gets at societally being able to uncouple weight and health.
Yeah.
And I feel like folks who are ready for that conversation are like screaming from the rooftops, and that then they are a small group. They're a loud group, and I'm thankful for the group. But it's difficult when just how you frame that to say, you know, to get informed consent and this can be harmful. And I can hear the person on the back end saying, but don't you know the harm that keeping the weight on is going to, you know, it's that pushback where that tension is there. And I don't know that we're just as a society ready to have that conversation. It certainly doesn't seem like it.
Oh, it's hard. It's hard. You know, I think that, and this is why I really wanted to have this conversation about why diets don't work, is because even when we present people and even when people can read it and they can believe it when they hear it and see it, even in their lived experience, like their decades of lived experience tells them that this is true to, you know, to the core of who they are, there's always a but that is always hanging there. And it's either coming from them, their loved ones, their healthcare providers. And they're like, but shouldn't I still keep trying? Shouldn't I? And so, yeah, I think you're right. I think there's so many other conversations that we don't have time for, but, that you know, need to be happening.
Yeah. And it's a fair point. I understand that and have, you know, hold space for that feeling of like, well, shouldn't I try? Because as a person out in the world, you are rewarded for showing up in a body that looks a particular way, particularly as a woman. You have, you know, there are different things that you are afforded to, or ways that people treat you, or all of those things just societally, that even if it's not, if it's taken out of the health realm, it makes sense that that would want to be, but yes, I should keep doing this because unfortunately, some of those things are true. You would be treated in a different way. And yeah, it does. Yeah. It's a tough one.
Oh, yeah. And I've shared things before, too, that, you know, I'll never fault someone for desiring weight loss.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Because that is the default in our society. Mm-hmm. You know, even people who, by all measures, live in a smaller body, you'll still find most people who are trying to lose those 5 pounds.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Okay. So now let's try and shift it around a little bit. So hopefully people who are listening, who maybe didn't understand when they would hear people like us say diets don't work, have a little bit more background on why those of us in this non-diet space are so passionate about making sure we're getting the message out, even if the world isn't ready to hear it as much as we want them to.
Yeah.
Now let's talk about getting excited about food, because, you know, food matters, just not the way we've been led to believe. Food can do wonderful things for us. And food happens to be something we need to eat every day. So right. Let's talk about.
Yes.
So how do you get people excited about food once they're, you know, once they start thinking like, I want to eat better. Let's use that. Like,
yeah.
What does eat better mean?
I'm glad you asked that question. I feel like part of the work has to come first in unpacking all the stuff that we just talked about. I feel like that's an important part, because otherwise it slips into, well, what does better mean? And does it have to be this many grams of this, and how many times a day? And what's the, you know, it can easily get right back into there. So it feels like the intention behind things is a big part to me of what matters. You know, diet culture doesn't own salads. If you want to have one, enjoy. And there's that feeling though, of like, if I eat a vegetable and I don't put dressing on it, is that because of, like, it's rediscovering, I think, a lot of what your rules were and are, where they came from, if they serve you, because some things do potentially serve you. If I make sure that I eat every couple of hours, I'm, you know, not hangry and rude to people. You know, like, some of those things might be helpful if you tend to work for long hours and you need a reminder to eat. And, you know, you can have some rules in place, but what are the ones that serve you and which ones don't? And then great questions of, like, you know, what are the foods that you like? And sometimes that's really difficult to think through if you've been eating the rice cakes, not because you like them, but to actually go back and maybe do some experiments with it. I really like to look at the whole thing as an experimental mindset of, let's try this and see what happens, you know, and like, let's try to see if you want to have breakfast before you go out for your run. How did that go? You know, or maybe next time it needs to be a little less than that because it didn't go so well. Or maybe it needs to be more than that because you found that you needed more energy. And like, how does someone begin to gear that for what their life looks like, whether they are an athlete or they're taking care of their family or their whatever they're doing? How is that going to support your day so that you feel good, but it often things actually taste good because it's supposed to? You know, there's a part of that of food is supposed to taste good so that evolutionarily we would go and seek it, because otherwise why would we bother going out to get it if it didn't bring us some type of enjoyment? And you hear that a lot for people who are in like bodybuilding spaces who are just like, I'm so tired of eating chicken and broccoli. It's like, well, no wonder, because all you're doing is eating chicken and broccoli, like, and it's dry and boring. So yeah, you would get sick of it because it's not, there's no pleasure involved in that. So I think if you start seeing, you know, what's your intention? How do you want to feel? And then some of that feeling is like the taste of it too. Like, oh, I want to feel like this was yummy. That's also part of it. Yeah.
And just feeling like satisfied, that feeling of satisfaction that is intangible. And man, I wish we could wear a watch that would tell us that, because that I feel like would actually help people to realize like, oh, that satisfaction factor, it's really a thing.
Yeah. And it's challenging and working through, you know, sometimes I think intuitive eating very much gets on this. It's the hunger and fullness diet. You know, when am I hungry and when am I full? And like assessing some of that, you know, of when are you hungry and when are you actually full? And it's okay if you are full and you're still going to enjoy more because of whatever reason. But part of that whole thing, whether it's hunger or fullness or satisfaction or pleasure, is actually the pausing. Mm-hmm. And you making a decision. And when you've spent a lot of times following, this is my frozen meal and this is what I get. And so I am going to eat all of it because it's a whopping 200 calories for lunch. So I'm going to like get all the sauce and every bit. You're just eating it because who knows when you're going to eat again and what it's going to be. So I'm going to get every piece. And so a lot of times I've worked with folks who are like, I don't know when I'm full. I just eat what I'm given.
Yes.
Because that is what I've done. I've packed the thing, I've done the meal prep, and so I eat all of it. And so even like revisiting that to feel like, oh, I might want more of that. Or actually, no, I don't need all of that. You know, and it could vary from day to day, and that's okay. It's just really interesting to work through for yourself.
It is, and that pre-portioning or like deciding ahead of time what you're allowed to have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a hallmark of diet culture too. I mean, how many people, and I used to be one of them, I would like plan my day before I had 2 feet on the ground, sometimes the night before, right? And so I would decide ahead of time what I was allowed to have, and I was going to have it whether I wanted it or not because I had decided that I was allowed to have it.
Yes, yes, that part too.
Mm-hmm. And so when you're faced with the question of like, well, what do I want? How much do I want? How much do I need to feel satisfied? You know, what is going to be my stopping prompt? Mm-hmm. It can feel overwhelming. I mean, we make it sound easy, and intuitive eating makes it sound like this lovely thing of like, oh, eat when you're hungry stuff, when you're
just
full.
Just do it. Yeah.
But it really is a little bit more than that. Like there has to be, you know that. But you know, I think for a lot of people who try intuitive eating on their own, they get discouraged because they feel like they're doing something wrong because they don't get it quickly.
Yeah. And that's the whole idea, right? If it's an experiment where times it went well and other times you're like, okay, well, that didn't work out. And, you know, you don't have, because diets are so rigid that you are either doing it right or doing it wrong or you're on or you're off versus this is just how this meal went or this snack went or this day went or, you know, and how it worked one day is going to be different than another day. But you touched on something that made me think of, tapping into like body needs. And one of the things that I've noticed too, like if you are sick and have some type of illness, you know, you very much are tuned into that. No one is going to make you eat. If you have an upset stomach or like you have a high fever and your appetite is just like, no, you know, or there's certain things that you will tolerate and you're very in tune with yourself in that moment of like, I will have some saltine crackers or maybe I'll have this broth or, you know, someone might need to convince you to keep taking some liquids, but you do have a sense of yourself. And I do wonder sometimes, I mean, I'm just speculating too, is some of it is like in those moments you have slowed down. Mm-hmm. And you actually are into, you have nothing else to think about except the next show you might watch because you're not feeling well, you know, versus other times where we just don't slow, we're just unconsciously going about our day and food is just something we fit in to part of it to not enjoy not that everything needs to be at a candlelit dining room table with your finest china, because that's not real life either. But even just the check-in of the hunger, the check-in of the fullness, the check-in of the satisfaction is something that diets do not teach us to do.
They don't. One of the things that I love talking to people about doing is, you know, if they're used to plating things at the stove or, you know, putting it on the plate in the kitchen and then putting it on the table, I invite them to have this little experiment and get curious. Like I use the language of like, let's try this on.
Yeah.
And, you know, trying on putting it all on the table, leading with satisfaction. So like serving it, you know, family style buffet style, lead with satisfaction. What do you want first? What looks good? What looks interesting? What are you most excited to taste? Start with that. Then kind of work your way down the list. And it's really interesting what people will say is, I took a lot more of one thing, a lot less of something else, but often they realize that they either needed more or less than they would have previously put on their plate, right? And so we get into this autopilot of like, you put, you know, potatoes on one side, meat on the other, and, you know, we just kind of go into autopilot because that's what our brain does. Our brain's like habits that save time and energy. So putting food on a plate is one of the things we do several times a day, every day of our lives. And so I think that just inviting curiosity into that, like, what do I want?
Yeah.
Can be so novel, right? Talking about the novelty factor. Like there can be some excitement there that can really, I think, be the guiding light towards this healthier relationship.
Yeah. And that really comes into the place of relearning trust with yourself, because at some point we've had it, at some place it was lost along the way, but relearning that trust, which is challenging if you've had, you know, books, plans, programs tell you all the things that you should do and you couldn't possibly make those decisions. And so it opens up a whole new world when you are the one who gets to make those decisions, and it takes a minute to be okay with that.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. This has been a great conversation. I love talking to you. I think I'm going to have to have you back. If you'll have me,
I would love to chat more. Absolutely.
Okay. But before we kind of wrap up, two questions. One is, where can people learn more from you and about you? Because I think that they will certainly want to connect with you after hearing you.
Yeah. I mean, more formally, my website is just, my name is amyporto.com, but where I like to play most is on Instagram. So I'm happy to chat with folks. Yes, it is where we met. It's where all great relationships form. but I'm someone who likes to chat in the DMs. I'm good for a voice memo. So yeah, I love to kind of, that's more of my playground, I think, of being able to chat with folks. And
awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, and we're going to put all your links and stuff in the show notes.
Oh, amazing.
My favorite final question, what do you think is the missing ingredient in midlife?
I know. It's funny. Before we hit record, you gave me this question. I said, I'm going to think about it the whole time, and I did not. So now I'm going to go with the first thing that came into my head without trying to filter it, is permission.
Oh, yes.
Permission.
And permission bubbles to the surface, right? It's like, it's waiting to chomp at the bit in midlife.
Yeah. I feel that as someone who is turning 50 this year, I feel a lot of those things coming up where maybe you felt, and not even just in related to food, but in so many areas of life, that you're waiting for this, but I have to be okay with that. Like all of those things. And suddenly midlife comes and it's like, wait, yeah, I don't, the only permission I need is myself to do those things. And so that has bubbled up recently.
Ooh, I love that. Thank you so much for joining me today. I know that listeners are going to get a lot out of this conversation. I appreciate your time. I appreciate your expertise. Mm. And we will definitely look forward to having you back another time.
Well, I appreciate the invitation. Thank you for having me. And I look forward to chatting in the future.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Midlife Feast. For more non-diet health, hormone, and general midlife support, click the link in the show notes to learn how you can work and learn from me. And if you enjoyed this episode and found it helpful, please consider leaving a review or subscribing, because it helps other women just like you find us and feel supported in midlife.